If the court please, I'm Donna Skinner Reed, a deputy district attorney with the First Judicial District. My bar number is 8446, and I'm here representing the people on this issue of whether Miller should apply retroactively to cases that were final many years ago. This defendant committed first-degree murder, found to be guilty of deliberate and intentional murder of a 14-year-old girl. And that murder occurred in 97, and the defendant at that time was 16. He was sentenced to life with no possibility of parole, and in addition, he's given 48 years consecutive to his life sentence for the kidnapping and other sentences on the other charges that were concurrent with either the life or the 48. The conviction was final at the end of 99 or early 2000. The mandate was received in early 2000 after the direct appeal. I think neither side has argued that Miller created a new rule and that Mr. Behill's conviction was final. And so we've come to the issue of whether Miller would be applied retroactively to Mr. Behill. There was a 35C motion in front of the, at the trial level. Of course, the trial judge had retired, the one who heard the case originally. And that motion asked that the sentence be vacated and a new sentencing hearing be ordered. And that motion was granted. And we appealed.
Counsel, was there a new sentencing hearing granted as to the consecutive sentence for 48 years?
No.
So that's going to be served regardless?
Yes. Yes. The only, and actually, absent some argument, the other crimes would be beyond the collateral attack statute, where first-degree murder doesn't have a set of years, but the other charges would be barred, with absent finding an exception. The in looking at retroactivity, Edwards from the Colorado Supreme Court adopted T, and the T from U.S. Supreme Court analysis in deciding when cases that set forth a new rule should be applied retroactively. And in looking at this case, that analysis would be whether or not the rule is substantive or procedural. And procedural rules are not applied retroactively. And the way the question is answered on whether it's substantive or not is whether it narrows the class of persons or it narrows the conduct that can be reached by the criminal law. And it's our position that that did not happen in Miller, because juvenile homicide defendants can still be given a life sentence without a possibility of parole, and therefore, and they can certainly still be found guilty of first-degree murder. So it did not change those things.
But didn't Miller just simply take off the table an automatic life sentence without the possibility of parole? In other words, that sentencing scheme that's embedded in the statute, the Supreme Court said, no, that's unconstitutional.
Well, it said you needed to do a different analysis and consider the mitigation, the things about the juvenile. It did require a discretionary approach to, it did require other things to be considered. But it didn't take off the table a life without parole sentence.
But counsel, if I understand it, the time Mr. Behill was sentenced, the only choice of the trial court was to impose life without parole. Miller, however, requires a state whether it likes it or not, to permit a trial court to sentence a defendant to something less. It's unclear, and you folks don't really want to, haven't really talked about it very much in your briefs, but some other remedy. So the sentence that's now available to, assuming this Miller applies to this case, that's now available is substantively different. So isn't that a rule of substance?
Well, there have been many courts who found it's not.
And many more that have found that it is.
Yes.
Not many more, but a similar number or greater.
Yes, there have been a number of courts that have gone both ways. But, and it did not make a life sentence illegal. It talked about a possibility of parole. So it's not the sentence itself, it's the possibility of parole. You can still have a life sentence as long as there's a possibility of parole. It doesn't have to be some lesser sentence.
Doesn't have to, but it could, couldn't it?
Well, I'm not sure. I guess that goes to the remedy section, and I probably was a bit premature, because at the trial level, the Supreme Court was already granting cert on those issues. And so I assumed if we got to the issue of a remedy, we would be soon having a decision from the Supreme Court.
Well, what is your position on remedy? Because we don't know when the Supreme Court may rule. We have to rule. We have a responsibility,
yes,
to decide this case. So what is your position with respect to the remedy?
Well, of the, I think, basically three Court of Appeals decisions that I'm aware of that suggested three different remedies, I would find the Gutierrez-Ruiz court's decision more in keeping with the Supreme Court decision. That was mentioned in the supplemental Denver District Court opinion that I attached, and that is 14 COA 1. Yes, all right. And that remedy was that the court could determine whether or not it would apply a life sentence without parole. And if it didn't apply a life sentence without parole, then that it would apply the 40-year parole, as the Attorney General has argued, because then it would be unconstitutional as to that specific defendant, and the prior law would provide the 40-year possibility of parole. But I think more importantly that it is not retroactive. Just because it could make a difference, any of the laws that have been found not retroactive can make a difference in the outcome, and the courts have recognized that. The Edwards case itself found Crawford not retroactive, so we could have people who've been convicted with testimonial hearsay.
Are there any cases you're aware of where the range of sentence has been changed, as in this case? Are there any cases you found that deal with retroactivity on that issue?
Well, I guess not specifically. Well, in a way, I guess, on whether it's, I guess it's not the range, because I guess you could always have death or life, but as the Michigan opinion points out, all the death penalty cases which have provided for, increased discussion about having discretion in the sentencer and that kind of thing, they have all been applied prospectively and not retroactively, because they are seen as procedural. And any holding that's not applied retroactively you could conceivably suggest that there are different outcomes that might have happened. But there is a real value on the other side that I think needs to be considered in the finality. Both Edwards and Teague talk about the value of finality at some point in these convictions that are final. And that is the resources that are involved in from the judicial and the state in retrying, reinvestigating the kind of hearing you're talking about here. It's massive on a horrible case with victims and prosecutors, and you would now we should go back 17 years and try to figure out who he was at 16. He's in his 30s now. There is a value in finality, and I think that's what's expressed by the cases that do not apply retroactive to cases that are final.
How many, do you have, I don't know if you know, but do you know how many people that have been tried in your district fall into this category?
One. This is...
That's the only one you know of, or you know that's the only one?
No. We have one that's on direct appeal, that's mm-hmm. taped, that's in front of the Supreme Court, and we have one that would fall in Mr. Vigil's category.
In addition to Mr. Vigil?
No.
Mr. Vigil.
Mr. Vigil, yes.
If the Supreme Court had held that a court just could not sentence a juvenile to life in prison without parole, would that have been a substantive rule?
Yes, I think that would be more like Graham and Roper, because they held you can't sentence a juvenile to death, and you can't sentence a non-homicide, a juvenile who did not commit a homicide, you can't sentence them to a life in prison without parole. So they would that would be more in line with them. And I think Miller itself recognized that it's different than those two cases in the language that's cited in the briefs. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time if there's not another question right now. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Stacey Nelson Colling, and I'm here representing Mr. Frank Vigil. Miller v. Alabama created a substantive rule of constitutional law, and as such should be applied retroactively. What Miller v. Alabama did is created a categorical change in the possible sentence for juveniles convicted of first-degree murder. It changed it from mandatory life without parole, mandatory life without parole, no other option, to what is, in fact, at this point, based on the language of Miller, a presumption against life without parole for any juvenile. And I get there by citing Miller in the language that says life without parole for a juvenile should be rare.
Counsel?
Yes.
The majority in Miller said, and I quote, "Our decision does not categorically bar a penalty for a class of offenders or type of crime. Instead, it mandates only that a sentencer follow a certain process, considering an offender's youth and intended characteristics, before imposing a particular penalty." That seems to directly contradict what you just said. They said we are not categorically barring a penalty.
They do say that, and at the same time, they categorically ban mandatory life without parole.
But that equates mandatory with punishment. Punishment is the life in prison without parole.
Right.
When you read the mitness, it doesn't say mandatory life without parole. It says life without parole. That's the sentence. That's the punishment. Whether it's imposed mandatorily or discretionally, the punishment does not change. The punishment is to prison for a length of time under certain conditions. None of that changes whether it's mandatory or discretionary.
And I would respectfully disagree with that and state that it has changed. It has changed because what the court has now declared is that the fact that a juvenile brain is different than an adult brain, the fact that a juvenile is not just a little adult, is a matter of constitutional law now. It has to be taken into account before you can impose life without parole. It has to be taken into account because it's so important. And we know that now, and we're recognizing that now. And it's so important that juveniles shouldn't be sentenced to life without parole unless it's a rare circumstance. It shouldn't be 100% of the cases of the 50 children, 50 juveniles that were sentenced to life without parole here in this state before 2006. So based on that, there is, per the language of Shiro v. Summerlin, the U.S. Supreme Court says, it's substantive if it carries a significant risk that a defendant faces a punishment that the law cannot impose on him. In this case, it clearly does. All of these 50 juveniles are facing life without parole when there is a significant risk under this new law that says it should be only imposed in rare cases. And because they're all serving it.
But it can be imposed upon them. Shiro says that cannot be imposed upon them. And the court here was very clear. It can. That's what the Miller court said. It can. We're not categorically barring that penalty. You just have to have a hearing in which you consider certain things. The court can still impose the penalty. So there's no categorical bar. I guess it seems like your answer is non-responsive. This seems to be an appeal for sympathy. We have juveniles. But there are dozens of Supreme Court cases finding constitutional violations for all classes of offenders, and yet determining they're not retroactive. It's not enough to say there's a constitutional problem. That doesn't answer the question. We have, for example, we have the Apprendi case, the Blakely case, where the court says a jury's got to decide these factors, or else you can't aggravate the sentence. Well, that affects the sentencing range, and yet in each of those circumstances, the Supreme Court has said those decisions are not retroactive. What I'm getting at here is, how is the punishment categorically different? How is any punishment been categorically barred by Miller?
And I don't mean to be repeating myself and I'm being unresponsive, but I think it's informative that this is the conversation going on nationwide. In the eight cases, the eight high courts that have found it is substantive, and they have found that it is a substantive change because banning mandatory life without parole is a categorical ban. And in the states that have found that it's procedural, they've found the other way. So this is an argument that's been going on, and all I can say is that I maintain that it is a categorical change. I understand that they said in Miller this is not a categorical change. However, at the same time, they imposed a categorical change. And I would further say that in Miller v. Alabama, in that very case, they applied this mandate retroactively to the companion case of Jackson v. Hobbs. This case has been applied retroactively. They knew what they were doing when they took a habeas case and they took a direct appeal case. And when they applied it to him, they triggered the constitutional right that all similarly situated defendants be treated similarly. And I would add, in Colorado, we have a situation where there have been several juveniles sentenced to life without parole who have been given relief under Miller because the Attorney General's office has not contested the retroactivity of Miller in those cases. And I just listened again to the oral argument before I came here in Jensen, which is one of the Supreme Court cases, the one that took up someone on collateral review, and the Attorney General's representative said, we believe it's fair and just that all of these defendants should be treated equally. They should all get the benefit of this new law. And I think that is the right answer, that it's fundamentally unfair and unjust if some cases on collateral review get relief and some don't, just based on what city they were sentenced in.
But that happens, frankly, all the time. You have many cases where the Supreme Court has said this. In one case, for example, procedurally identical to this one, the court took a collateral attack case, reversed the conviction under a new rule, and 2 years later said it doesn't apply to anybody else. It's not retroactive. So the mere fact that it reverses in a particular case doesn't tell us anything about whether it's going to deem it retroactive. And I'd like to point out that in Jackson, which was the companion case to Miller, the court didn't vacate the sentence. It didn't do that. It simply sent it back to the lower courts for reconsideration in light of Miller. So it didn't say, our holding here applies to you, Mr. Jackson. It didn't do that. It just sent it back for reconsideration.
I want to explore something you said a few minutes ago, and I want to make sure I wrote down correctly what you said. Not verbatim, but this is what I gathered from it, that if Miller is not applied retroactively to Mr. Vigil, that what I wrote down was Mr. Vigil would face punishment that the law cannot impose on him. Is that your argument?
That it creates a significant risk that he's serving a sentence that the law cannot impose on him.
Because the law can only impose that sentence after the hearing that was mandated by Miller. Is that?
Exactly, and after finding that he is one of the rare cases in which life without parole for a juvenile is appropriate. Exactly.
In Jackson, I think I've read that the prosecution did not raise the issue of retroactivity. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding. They didn't.
And the Supreme Court doesn't have to take up something if it's not raised, right? Doesn't have to take up an argument if it's not raised.
Correct.
So can we fairly draw a conclusion from Jackson versus Hobbs?
I think it's persuasive. I think it's persuasive when the Supreme Court has applied a rule to a defendant that's similarly situated to the defendant that we're here about today. I think it is very persuasive.
You're saying that in Colorado there are several people who are in identical circumstances to Mr. Vigil who have received the benefit at least of the retroactivity. But so that would be another inequity that you're looking at?
Absolutely.
Counsel, what's your position on the remedy if we decide it's retroactive? Because again, the briefs didn't really flesh that out real well. And as has been pointed out, there are different decisions by divisions of this court on what the appropriate remedy is. What's your position on the appropriate remedy?
I'm going to dodge that question as best as I can because I think that it's not appropriately decided in this case. This case is about retroactivity and retroactivity only. The remedy is something that needs to be changed either by the legislature or will potentially be changed by the Supreme Court in the case we get heard this summer. But this that issue is not before this court. What's before this court is whether the trial court appropriately ordered a resentencing hearing and whether that hearing should happen.
But counsel, but we have to let the court know what to do with the resentencing hearing. I guess that's the problem. We can't just remand and say, figure it out on your own. I think
it's a quandary that we're in because the legislature has failed to act and because we don't have direction from the Colorado Supreme Court yet. I don't have a direct answer for that. I don't know the right answer to that. All I know is that Mr. Vigil is entitled to a hearing, and it's something other than life without parole.
Ms. Colling, on the first page of the answer brief, the people do ask their second question is, if Miller is retroactive, whether the court should have imposed a sentence of life with the possibility of parole after 40 years instead of ordering a new sentence hearing. So I don't know that we can say that the issue is not frontless. I don't mean to push you on your dodge, but I think it isn't. I will agree they didn't well develop the argument, and I think counsel kind of admitted that. But isn't it an issue before us?
In that sense, yes, it is in some way in a skeletal form.
And I want to push you on your dodge.
Okay.
How do you respond to that?
Well, my position is that 40 to life, my position is 40 to life is still a mandatory penalty. And that pursuant to Miller and Graham and Roper and that body of law, that I'm not going to concede that 40 to life is appropriate for every single individual. I think the individual hearing and some range of penalty is appropriate. You know, am I qualified to say this is the range? I've heard arguments that the Class II felony range of 16 to 48 would be appropriate. I have heard, you know, lowering the bottom of so a 10 to life or a 20 to life or parole after a certain amount of time is the right answer. I don't know. I think the legislature needs to flesh that out and so does and or the Supreme Court. But all I can say is that I do not agree that 40 to life is the appropriate on paper, resentencing to 40 to life is appropriate.
Is it, as I asked initially, the case that the other sentences are not an issue here? So the consecutive 48-year sentence, for example, is not an issue?
I do not concede that as well.
But it hasn't been raised, that I can tell, by anybody. Challenge is only to this sentence on this charge and conviction. There's no challenge that I've seen to the sentence on any other conviction. So regardless of whatever happens on remand, there's still going to be service time of that sentence, and then on top of that, 48 years starting thereafter.
And I can just tell the court that I'm aware of one case that is pending decision by the Colorado Supreme Court, Hunsinger, that takes up that issue, that takes up the issue of whether when one conviction, one specific count is overturned as unconstitutional, should, and if you need to be resentenced on that count, should you be also resentenced on all of the other counts? And that has been pending for, I think, about a year now, so hopefully we'll have an answer on that at some point here. And we haven't spent much time on it, but I would like to emphasize that the first remedy that I'm requesting is dismissal of this appeal for lack of jurisdiction. I think there's a permanent order.
How do you explain the rule which specifically says it is appealable?
It says, in general, 35C denials or grants are appealable, but it's also subject to the statute 1612.102, and there's no specific delineated exception for when there's a resentencing order, like there is when a 35C is granted and a retrial is ordered. They specifically carved out that exception. They did not carve out an exception for resentencing.
The legislature did.
Correct. And that's explained in People v. Smith, Colorado Appeals, 1996.
But what's the principle that would support drawing that kind of a distinction? What would be served in the former case that wouldn't be served in the latter, or vice versa? And I guess I don't see a principle distinction between the two situations.
I think there's a very principle distinction between a trial and a resentencing. A trial, you're talking about, I think, more prejudice to the prosecution in terms of people are not available anymore, memories have faded, et cetera, et cetera. A resentencing hearing under Miller is based solely on the juvenile and his history and things that were never considered by the court. And it's a much different, much shorter, direct issue. There's no jury involved. I think that's the reason why they carved out that exception for the new trial, is because a new trial is a big deal. We want to make sure that's the right decision before we go that far. But a resentencing hearing is not quite as onerous.
And you're suggesting that on resentencing, they would not be able, the prosecution could not raise the nature of the crime of which the defendant was convicted. That would be off limits. All you can do is talk about the juvenile.
No, I'm sorry if I misspoke and said that. That is one factor, clearly, is okay. The part that the defendant played in the crime. And so I would just ask the court to remand to the trial court for the hearing that it previously incorrectly ordered.
Thank you.
If the court please, I disagree strongly that that ordering a resentencing hearing wouldn't be a pretty huge order. And I don't know whether counsel has participated in any of these transfer hearings that have, in our jurisdiction, have taken a week or something, with where they brought in evidence of DNN actions, mental health actions, teachers to testify about different things about the juvenile. And that's the kind of thing I guess I foresee in this kind of hearing, that there would be a lot of evidence. And because this is a 17-year-old case, it's in front of a trial judge who did not do the trial. And certainly if we wanted the judge to consider the facts of the case, that would require some evidence also, because you would want the person who was doing the sentencing to be as familiar as Judge Villano was, and I quoted what he said about this case. This was a drastic, big case. Two of the co-defendants, we sought death penalties on. One of them was granted and was set aside because it was decided by a three-judge panel. This is, this kind of reliving by everyone involved is a big order. So I agree with the court. There's not that much difference that it should be decided whether it's retroactive or not before we would put everyone through this kind of sentencing hearing. I see this as not even your regular typical sentencing hearing when you're talking about these kinds of factors. And I think we come back to any time there's a new rule, yes, the people who don't get the benefit of it might have been better off with it, but yet our courts have been very reluctant to apply it in any broad way. That is the narrow holding, that they should not be applied very often retroactively because of the cost to the system and to the people involved. And that's why, like I said, Teague, Batson wasn't retroactive. That Summerlin, Ring, not retroactive. They're those people who were already final. If they got decided death by a judge, that stood. Edwards, Crawford, not retroactive. Johnson, Blakely, not retroactive. So it is a balance between giving someone the benefit of a new rule and paying the cost of finality. And both sides asked the lower court to await the decisions in Tate and Banks before having a sentencing hearing. Both sides asked the court for that at the trial level. And now there's the third. But the two published cases are Banks and Gutierrez-Ruiz.
I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that whichever way we rule, one of you is going to appeal. So that issue will get taken care of.
Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments. The case is submitted. The bailiff can announce recess.